Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm out here at the Emerald Earth in the woods in Northern California, and it's very beautiful, and I'm here with Michael Smith, who lives here, and we are looking at lives in this community. We'll hear about the community, and we're looking at a house, which I think is a Cobb house, and you say, Michael, that building structures is your specialty.
My specialty is in what we call natural building specifically. And natural building starts really with the premise that you look at the site itself and include the site in all your decisions about what materials you're going to use. So here at Cobb is just one of a whole series of different natural building techniques that we're using. Cobb, the only Cobb part of this structure is the hearth. And the Cobb is used there as a sculptural element and also as a heat retaining.
And Cobb is straw and dirt.
Cobb is a mixture of clay, sand, and straw mixed together and sculpted basically while wet. Mm-hmm. So none of the exterior, Cobb does not give you very good insulation value. It has a very high thermal mass. And thermal mass and insulation are the two pieces that are really necessary for an effective passive solar structure. Our insulation in this structure comes mostly from straw bales and from a third technique that we call light straw clay, which is a traditional German technique, mostly straw with a little bit of clay slip, and it's packed into formwork, sort of like making rammed earth. And that's what the front east and south and part of the southwest walls here that you're seeing. You can still see it because the plaster hasn't gone onto it yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you could do such beautiful things. I've seen a lot of pictures of Cobb structures, Cobb houses, and I'm looking at this and I'm seeing the dolphin just carved as part of the actual structural wall, and the shelf is there just sculpted out.
Yeah, that's one of the really special properties that Cobb itself has is the incredible sculptableness of it. It's really just like sculpting your home out of clay.
Sitting in your art studio,
right,
making a clay,
right,
house. You don't need nails.
Your art studio can be an art piece itself. The way we try to make decisions is we start, like I said, with the site and looking at the resources that are available on the site. Here, on this particular site, we have a lot of forest. And what we're looking to do as we build our structures is we're looking to mitigate some of the environmental damage that's been done in the past by forestry practices here, which have basically included clear cutting. Mm-hmm. And what you get after a clear cut in Northern California is you get a very, very dense regrowth of small saplings, which one of the problems that is a lot of fire damage or potential for catastrophic fire. The other problem is that, you know, disease and so forth is more of an issue because you have such a dense growth, which really isn't natural in this kind of ecosystem. So one of the things that, you know, we like to leave all the big trees here to make the forest. But we harvest very small poles, sort of in the 4-inch to 10-inch or 12-inch range, which we have, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of. And those become actually the structural parts, in some cases, the structural parts of buildings. And you can see if you step forward a little bit, we've actually used curved poles to define the curved ridge beam of the roof of this house. So you can, in natural building, we like to use materials and use wood specifically that are considered waste products or recycled, that wouldn't be considered commercially viable by the timber industry. And pretty much what we're trying to do is offer sort of a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of looking at resources. And as opposed to the industrial resource paradigm, where you want to harvest all the biggest, all the best stuff, and you want to treat it all exactly the same, what we do instead with natural building is we say, what's here on the site that we can harvest either without causing significant environmental damage, or in some cases, even to, through that harvesting process, even to mitigate damages that have been done by previous land use practices.
Mm-hmm. Great. Are there other examples of that?
Yeah. One of the things, another example of what we call regenerative building, we harvest a lot of our sand and gravel that goes into our buildings out of our creek. Sand and gravel are both things that are required in large quantity in lots of buildings. You know, concrete, for example, which we avoid using as much as possible in natural building. But for drainage purposes, for cob itself, for our adobe floors, for our plasters, sand and gravel are essential components. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the, you know, gravel yard and purchase gravel, there's two sources. Round rock and some sand is harvested out of riverbeds, and of course that's a huge contributor to habitat degradation for salmon and contributes to silting up of the spawning grounds, the gravel in the rivers that the salmon need. The other source, the other commercial source of gravel is by basically tearing apart and smashing up mountainsides into tiny little pieces, and that had a lot of environmental impact too. We have, on this property, we have a seasonal creek which runs right through the center of the property. And you can, we've identified one area of the creek that's obviously a lot of silt and sand and gravel has built up. The creek beds look completely different from anywhere else on the property. And what we've done is, over the last 3 seasons of construction, we've started harvesting and processing sand and gravel out of that creek. And what we're doing is reestablishing a settling basin in the creek, mm-hmm. so that in the winter, when the creek runs through that area, that basin is a place where the water will slow and it will drop a lot of its load of sediment and sand and silt that it's carrying. And that, of course, is mostly, around here, the two things that are contributing the most to erosion are the logging industry and the vineyard, you know, expansion, both of which turn up and loosen lots and lots of soil, and the soil ends up in the creeks. So we're doing our best to keep that sediment here on the property at the top of the watershed, and actually harvest it from here for use in our construction, so that it doesn't end up further down the creek in the year-round fish habitat and cause problems down there.
Wow, that's really interesting. Maybe you'd like to say something real brief, Michael, about the vineyard. Because people all over the place can be hearing this, and I bet you lots of them drink wine.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a huge issue here in Northern California. Most, right here in the Anderson Valley, most of the available good quality agricultural land has been bought, you know, and a lot recently, just in the last 5 years or so, has been bought and converted into vineyards. A lot of it was previously an apple orchard. Some of it was previously range land for cattle. So one of the issues is that makes it of concern for us is the amount of pesticide use that happens in the vineyards. And another
So folks, you're also getting those pesticides when you drink that wine, uh-huh. unless it's organic.
Yeah, we have, unfortunately, a vineyard creeps over right into the very top of our watershed here. So some of those pesticides are coming right through our creek. The other issue is just, you know, the consolidation of land that could be being used to grow food for people locally, increasingly into the hands of these large corporations that are monocropping, you know, just thousands and thousands of acres of wine grapes here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So that's great. You said you're recapturing the runoff. So that is that full of pesticides?
Well, there may be some amount of pesticides in here. In the winter here, we have lots and lots of rainfall. Pretty much all our rainfalls in about a 5 or 6 month period. So the amount of dilution that if there is pesticides in the stream here, that's probably fairly diluted. It is certainly having impacts on the fish and, you know, other aquatic creatures mm-hmm. further downstream. Not to mention, you know, of course, the workers, the agricultural workers who are exposed to it every day. And the children in the communities. So the pesticide issue is a very big issue up here.
So, Michael Smith, you were just talking with somebody else for a second about one company, because, of course, we are talking about specific corporations. We talk about land, you know, getting bought up by a few corporations. So what the corporation around here is?
Well, there's a number of different corporations, and I'd like to say also that a number of the vineyards locally are locally owned by, you know, small family operations. But the vineyard that's neighboring to our property is owned by Kendall Jackson, which is, I believe, the second biggest wine producer in California. So it's one of the big top vineyard and wine producers locally.
Well, that's so good to know for people, for our listeners, because, like I say, not only do these companies have particular names in terms of what's happening to the land, but also that's, you know, a name we see in the store, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To encourage people to buy organic, you know, as a big way to mitigate your contribution to pesticide use and poisoning of people and poisoning of fish and poisoning of soils.
So, Michael, we're talking about again about the building materials of this structure that we're in, and the subject of straw.
Yeah, like I said, most of our materials that we use here come from on-site as much as possible. One of the exceptions, the biggest exception, is that we use a lot of straw in the construction. In many different phases, we use it in the cob, we use it in the light straw clay, and two of the walls of the structure are actually made out of straw bales, stacked and plastered. So we import onto the site a lot of straw. It's relatively cheap, but what's more significant is that straw is a byproduct, essentially a waste product of the grain industry, and there's huge, huge, huge quantities of straw produced in California. You know, California is one of our biggest grain-producing regions. The figures in terms of how many straw bale houses you could build out of the amount of straw that's grown in California every year is, I forget, but I think it's in the millions, millions of houses that you could build entirely out of the straw that's considered essentially a waste product of the grain industry. And until recently, all of that straw pretty much was burned in the field after harvest, you know, which is one
polluting the air. Right?
Well, it's one of the biggest contributors to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and greenhouse gases, not to mention smog and particulate matter that people are breathing. About 5 years ago, the state of California passed new clean air legislation that basically forbid grain growers to burn straw in their fields. And that's, I think, a big step. But, you know, as a result, the grain growers had to figure out, well, what are we going to do with all this straw that we've just been burning in the fields? And interestingly, that's been a big, because the agricultural lobby is very, very powerful here in California, they've really gotten behind this idea of straw bale construction and thrown a lot of money and lobbyists and so forth. Mm-hmm. So California is one of several states that have adopted a statewide policy to make straw bale construction, you know, fairly easy. It's easy to get a permit, relatively easy to get a permit for a straw bale house here in California as a result of that clean air legislation.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear some good news, mm-hmm. I'll tell you. Yeah, because I know the permaculture garden that I have in my backyard, that was easy to get free straw. And so probably won't be free, but at least it's a step in the right direction that these companies are supporting that, making it easier to build straw bale houses. Mm-hmm. Also, licensing can often get in the way.
Yeah, sort of. Straw bale is kind of, in some senses, leading this whole family of natural building techniques in terms of code acceptability. And sort of mainstream acceptability. There's thousands of straw bale houses being built every year in this country, and that's a really relatively recent development. Some of the other things that we're seeing here, cob and light straw clay and wattle and daub and so forth, these are traditional techniques.
So cob is dirt. Well, say again what they exactly are.
Cob is a sculptable mixture of clay and sand and straw mixed together and built with while still wet. And cob is traditional from Britain. So it's an earthen building technique that's adapted specifically to a cold, rainy climate.
Like Ireland.
Yes. Lots of cob in Ireland and coastal Britain. And some of these, some of the cob houses even on the Irish coast are 500, 600, up to 800 years old, still surviving in perfectly good condition. And, it's interesting here because we're in California, we're a seasonal desert, but we're also a seasonal rainforest. So in the winter, we get lots and lots of rainfall. And that's usually one of the biggest concerns that people have when you start talking about earthen construction.
It could melt.
That's what people say. Why won't it just wash away in the rain? Why you turn all back into mud? Well, it's fairly easy to prevent that from happening. And the fact that there are, thousands and thousands of centuries old cob structures in Britain attests that. There's also, cob is a really, really simple technique. Common in other parts of the world too, West Africa, the Arabian Peninsula. There was a cob tradition in the southwestern United States before the Spaniards arrived. Also,
it's a Hopi houses. Is that style? Is that cob? I'm just thinking about what I might know. What
some of the Hopi. What we think of in terms of
Navajo.
Mostly what we think of, like if you think of Taos Pueblo or something like that, that's adobe, which is a similar thing. The main difference is that with adobe, the mud mixture is formed into blocks, into usually rectangular blocks, and those blocks are allowed to dry in the sun and then stacked up to make a wall. With cob, you're using the mixture while it's still wet and sculptable. And in addition to its sculptability, the other real big advantage that cob has is it's much, much more earthquake resistant than adobe because you don't have all the mortar joints. You don't have all the little seams between the separate blocks. That's the other reason why earth building often gets a negative reputation, particularly in earthquake zones, is because adobe structures particularly are relatively susceptible to earthquake damage. Cob, because it's monolithic. Rammed earth, also because it's monolithic. These earth building techniques are much, much better able to resist earthquake forces.
Interesting. So, Michael Smith, it's so interesting getting to know you as we walk around the Emerald Earth here, and as you show us different buildings and we're looking at different systems that you have, we can't begin to talk about it all, but I want to let people know, I should have done this in the beginning, but you should know that you can get books that Michael Smith has participated in. One is called The Art of Natural Building, Design, Construction, Resources. The other is called The Hand-Sculpted House, A Practical and Philosophical Guide to Building a Cobb Cottage. And these all have several authors, including Michael Smith. And we are here at Emerald Earth in Northern California right now talking about this and walking around and getting to know each other and looking at these structures. And since Michael's your specialty here is building, we'll just stick to that, even though there's you say you give a 14-hour class and we're talking for a half an hour here, not even. So I'd like to hear about the living roof. The next subject to tackle here.
Yeah, roofing, I mean, in natural building, wall systems is kind of considered the easy part. There's lots and lots of options for really, really good, fairly simple natural wall systems. Cob and straw bale and light clay and wattle and daub and rammed earth, and the list goes on and on and on. The parts that are considered a little bit more tricky usually are the foundation and the roof. And those are the parts that really, the reason why they're more tricky is because those are the parts of the structure that really have to stand up to water, to being exposed to water. And, you know, some of the traditional roof systems that are very functional and made completely out of natural materials include thatch, which is very common in many parts of the world, slate roofs. Here, where wood is plentiful, shakes and shingles and so forth. But one of the pseudo-natural roof systems that we've used quite a bit here is what we call a living roof. And the idea with a living roof is that you're using some kind of a waterproof membrane, which is generally not a natural material. It's generally a plastic or rubber product. But then you're putting straw and soil up on top of the roof. And that has several real positive qualities. The first is that they just look incredibly beautiful. You know, right? We don't tend to water our living roofs in the summertime, so the ones I've shown you have just pretty much looked like a dry, you know, golden California field. But in the winter, they turn green, and you can irrigate them, and you can keep, you can grow herbs and flowers and all kinds of stuff. They do, you know, to some extent, they mitigate the environmental impact of a house because you can think of it that you're just sort of lifting up the topsoil and slipping a house in between the topsoil and the subsoil. And there's still a biologically active, productive area up on top of that roof when you're finished.
I just have to let people know, I wish you could see, because these houses are so beautiful. And we're looking also at pictures in the books, the hand-sculpted house, and for one, and the Art of Natural Building, and we're actually sitting in one, and I said, oh my God, this is like a fairy tale house. Mm-hmm. This is, and it's just, but they don't have to be like this, of course. They could just look like an ordinary American wooden house. It can look any kind of way, but I think, and it's just so wonderful, the feeling of being surrounded by natural materials. It's just very wonderful. So I wish you could see the pictures, but we you can't. This is radio.
you really feel that difference being inside the house. You feel the connection with the earth. You feel the rounded sort of soft shapes and all the handwork that has gone into creating this structure, and you see it from the outside too. One of the things we're trying to do, both literally and figuratively, is create houses that sort of grow. We say houses that grow out of the site. And the living roof that you're referring to is one of the things that really contributes to that appearance from the outside. The roof itself is part of the natural environment when you're finished.
And I hate to get back to this mundane matter of money, but so you're using natural materials that are here where you live in the forest here in Northern California at this place called Emerald Earth. Do you have to spend much more money? And how would a person who doesn't have their own environment like this to draw from so well, how does that work?
Well, there's a pretty direct trade-off between labor and money when you're building a structure. The the less money you want to spend, the more you want to use natural sort of found and harvested materials from the site itself, there's a correlation of extra labor. Because when you buy building materials, you're basically paying for somebody to have already done the processing for you. These structures, these, you know, small houses that you've seen here, cost in the materials cost was between $2,000 and $4,000 for each of them. I've built houses a lot cheaper. I've built, you know, small houses for $400 or $500. So you're always making a trade-off. You know, how much labor do I have? How much time do I have? What are the resources that are available locally? And even if you live in the city, and even if you don't, you know, if you live in the city without access to all the incredible resources that we have here of trees and clay and so forth, there are, you know, free materials available pretty much everywhere. The city's actually an incredible, incredible resource for people who want to build inexpensively. Demolition sites, concrete chunks make a really good quality foundation. Used lumber, used windows and doors and so forth are really easy to get, you know, in urban areas. And even, sort of surprisingly, soil and clay are very, very easy to get in the city. There's a lot of excavation that happens for new construction, and you can often get those materials delivered free to your site if you live in a fairly dense population area.
Well, it's just a lot of wonderful information, and this is only part of it. I want to say also there are lights hanging from the ceiling. It's very comfortable where I'm sitting and everything I've seen, and the lights are solar-powered. And we can't tell you about everything, but it's so encouraging to know that there are systems that we can use if we just understand more and relate more to our environment. And you were saying, I didn't even use the word permaculture, which I use often. But if you want to say something real quick about that, Michael Smith, and also if you want to share anything about Emerald Earth, just very, very fast.
Yeah, permaculture, I mean, I consider natural building to be a subset of permaculture, which permaculture is really the pursuit of ways to live in harmony with our environment, and natural building is the building part of permaculture. And another part of permaculture really is how we live together and how we make decisions together and how we interact together as people. That's a really important part of sustainability. Where Emerald Earth is an intentional community, there's 10 of us who live here currently. We operate by consensus. We share income. Those are also some of our attempts towards living sustainably on the earth here.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked about food at all and how about growing food, but maybe another show. That would be great. Do you want to give any contact information? You say volunteers come work here, can stay for varying amounts of time.
Yeah, I can be contacted via email. My email address is lorax, L-O-R-A-X, at ap.net.
Lorax, L-O-R-A-X, at ap.net. And there are these books that Michael Smith has participated in editing and writing for: The Hand Sculpted House, A Practical and Philosophical Guide to Building a Cobb Cottage, and The Art of Natural Building. So thank you so much, Michael Smith. It's been just extremely interesting.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.